Welcome to the Brown Posey Press Show, part of the Books Big Network, a program dedicated to independent and self-published authors. This show will examine new and unique works of literature, learn about their creators, and discuss the industry. And now your host, Tori Gates.
My guest today is Jill Evans, author of Travels with Jim. Two people of diverging backgrounds and ways meet on a strange cross-country odyssey. Jim is a drifter who thinks his father might be a famous Jim, while Sori is a girl of privilege, book smart, but unwise in the world around her. These two people somehow manage to tolerate and perhaps even learn a bit from one another. Jill Evans is a freelance writer. She has works in Newsday and the East Hampton Star. She is a teacher of creative writing at Suffolk County Community College on Long Island, and Travels with Jim is her first novel. Welcome aboard, Jill.
Hello.
Well, we are going to talk a little bit about a very intriguing work, and our publisher, Lawrence Knorr, was quite into it from the beginning. He had a great fascination with The Doors and Jim Morrison, and I had it to a lesser extent, though I was certainly exposed to it, and he turned up in an unpublished work of mine some years later. First, what inspired you to write this specific work about the travels?
I had several different influences, one of which was whether our parents are really our parents. I mean, we often move in a world of reality that's very Matrix-like in whether or not what we're hearing and seeing are actually the reality of the situation. I mean, it's very common today for people to read things on the internet or read things on the internet or hear things that are completely false, yet we take them as fact.
Right.
So that was one of the influences. The second one was, what if your parents were not really your parents? And I had seen a couple of documentaries on television, one of which dealt with foster children.
Right.
And circumstances often make up a family because they don't know the reality of their actual family situation in a lot of cases. Or if they do, their parents are so damaged that they want to believe that they came from somewhere else.
Right.
So that was a great influence on thinking about this idea.
And how did Jim Morrison pop up in terms of this such enigmatic character, such a poet, such a performer? How did he fit?
Well, I really wanted to explore whether or not, once again, taking from the foster care experience, I really wanted to explore whether a parent, whether your child, you were the child of a famous parent. And there's a really good poem by William Stafford, which says, if your mother died at birth and you didn't know your father, who would you be? Mm. And of course, the end of it. And I originally had thought, well, John Lennon would be great because he was a big rebel of the Beatles and he had quite a, you know, an over-the-top personality. But then I thought, no, he's actually a little too mild. We really need someone who lives in a certain perception. And if you read Jim Morrison's interviews, he talks a lot about perception and, you know, whether what we perceive is really our reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of intrigued me, and I started doing a lot of research and found that he would be a really intriguing character. And then I had the book, The Lords and the New Creatures, and I thought, well, let's kind of integrate his poetry into this, because his poetry talks about a lot of the themes that are present in the book.
Yeah. And I was taken specifically by the American Prayer Project, you know, the in the studio poetry and discussions and so forth. And the surviving members of the Doors put music around to some of it. And I heard that one night in college. This is like in the early 80s. And I'm going to admit I was probably fairly drunk at that time. I just remember it sort of being so intriguing to me. And I was like, wow, this is so different than the music. And it wasn't until sometime later that I really listened to it and drew some ideas from it for myself. And he was such a deeper character. He never really struck me as being comfortable with stardom. It would seem that after Light My Fire became a hit, he was very much of like, he didn't really want to do that song, and people would always be calling for that.
Well, I think if you see some of his interviews, he really abhorred commercialism. He admitted many, many times he wasn't in it for the money. He was not a follower of the fame monster. He really looked at his poetry and his songwriting as an artistic form. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he really wanted to be. He really wanted to be known for, specifically his poetry, because he was influenced by a lot of classical poets. And he also, he was a ferocious reader.
Yeah.
And not just the regular bestsellers of the day. He would read Greek mythology. He would read philosophers. He would read about religion. And so all of these concepts kind of wove their way into his creative expression. Mm-hmm. And so once again, I wanted to bring a lot of those threads into the book, not just to make it like a simple flat story,
right,
but to really stimulate people into thinking about how all of this works within their own life.
And isn't that how a lot of our stuff begins, with threads? And I've explained that in some of my own writing, that I just get these little threads of ideas and all of a sudden they come together in like this knot that you can't untie. And it's kind of fun that way.
The writer, that you have to leave a lot of it on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
Stuff that you really feel very passionately about and strongly about, but it doesn't work in some way with what you're trying to convey in your writing. And rather than, you know, kind of throw it away, you put it in a box and wait for the next good idea to come along and try to integrate it that way. But yeah, there was so much left on the cutting room floor, but I was really satisfied with the end product.
That's cool.
I mean, I had a lot of help, but once again, don't we all need help?
Exactly.
But once again, yeah. Well, for example, I had, I was kind of full of myself, and it took a long time to do all of the research and write the book, and I gave it to my friend. He was on a flight to Singapore and from the East Coast, and he really had nothing to do. So I said, I'll read my book. Let me know how you perceive it. And he came back, and I was thinking, oh, he's going to be so thrilled. Oh, he's going to give me these wonderful accolades. And he comes back, and he says, oh, this is so dark. These characters are so unlovable. Nobody's going to like them. You're going to have a very limited audience. And so I really had to be honest with myself and look at the work. And really, I mean, you know, you go through all of these five stages of grief. And I came to the conclusion he was right. And so I tossed the first 50 pages.
Wow.
That were probably the darkest part of the book. And in the introduction of these characters. And so I completely rewrote the beginning.
Right.
It was very painful, but he was right.
And
so, you know.
Yeah, and that's what we need, is we need that one reader who will be honest with us.
Exactly. And, you know, I had a lot of help from Lawrence. God bless him. He's such a genius. And my editor, Sarah. And they brought in some ideas that I hadn't thought about. And so You know, when I teach students about writing and about stories, you'll always have the one student that says, well, there's nothing wrong with my story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they critique it among their peers, there can be a lot of constructive criticism, if that's a word to say, or something where people can find improvements that will really enrich the story as a whole. So, you know, I think as writers, we just have to leave ourselves open to that.
Very true. Very true indeed. Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask about Jim, Sori, and these others in our next segment. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Sunbury Press Books brings you the work of independent authors from Pennsylvania and beyond. Check out Family Declassified by Catherine Finelli. If you're into baseball, Days of Reckoning by Ronald T. Waldo tells of the early 20th century glory days of the Pittsburgh Pirates. For politics, former Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor and Acting Governor Mark Single offers Seeking Truth in America. Find these and other great books at sunburypress.com.
We're back. Jill Evans, the author of Travels with Jim, is my guest, and let's get into these two rather enigmatic characters. Jim, first and foremost, who is this guy? Because he comes off as this very aloof, kind of self-absorbed, kind of self-centered character who's just kind of traveling. And he makes for just such an interesting person to start off with.
Well, he is very self-centered and extremely self-absorbed, because he kind of lives in a bubble of living, breathing Jim Morrison, going coast to coast on freight trains, stopping freight trains, looking for who he thinks is his father. Mm-hmm. And he is not well educated, but he's smart. But he suffers from a learning disability, and which makes it very hard for him to read Jim Morrison's poetry book. And he's of these poems. And lo and behold, fate kind of intervenes with Sori coming into his world. But again, he's very resentful. He only knows women through a 23-year-old's eyes. He has not had a lot of interaction with women or smart women. And so he gets a little, I would say, a little uppity. He gets a little resentful mm-hmm. that she has so many gifts that he longs for that he doesn't have.
Right. And I think we had talked somewhere along the line about an issue with one of the editors that we have about his attitude. And the thing, though, that you pointed out, and very correctly, you know, when Jim was in his heyday in the 60s, but even before that, growing up as he did, I think his father was in the military, if I remember correctly, he is a product of his environment. And that's a very different environment than today.
Right. I think I got a little bit of blowback from a few people indicating, particularly of a younger generation, I'd say generation Y and Z, that he was very misogynistic.
Right.
I don't think he comes off as misogynistic. He is, as you said, he's a product of the environment that he lives in. He does have those echoes of the women are inferior to men kind of complex that found its way through the 60s, but he grows to really grow a lot. It's not, you know, the reader has to really kind of look subtly at the way he changes his attitude. But he grows when he meets Sori, and he becomes a little less misogynistic. And I don't even like that word when it comes to this character, because I don't think he's misogynistic. I just think he's a product of a 60s attitude towards women.
Yeah. And I agree with you on that, because, I mean, he does not have the pathological hatred that, or the fear, which of course is the base for hatred of women. It's more like he just sees them in a box that he has been taught this is where they belong. And Sorry manages to change his mind as the book goes on a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're hitting it right on the head. He doesn't have a hatred for women or other people. He really belongs to a tribe of hobos and ne'er-do-wells that kind of need to survive. Mm-hmm. And he uses all of these elements, no matter wherever they come from, in order to survive.
Exactly.
I mean, I think there's a point in the book where he says, or he's thinking that, you know, if he sees a quarter in the hot asphalt on a street, he'll pick and pick and pick at that quarter to get to it rather than let it stay there. And that's kind of the way he feels about Sorry, that he's going to get to her. He's going to take her with him in a respect that he needs to understand her.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we also have to look at the element of love. He's not overtly in love. He doesn't express love or romance the way, you know, different novels might. But there is a love there.
Yeah. She kind of grows on him. And since he doesn't have the social skills, he clearly doesn't. And it's probably, Sorry may be the first person that he's ever physically come across who's female that does something for him or does something to him. And it's the first time that ever happens is it's not something you identify. You kind of see it, you kind of feel it, but it's like, sometimes it goes right over your head. You know, everybody's experience is a bit different.
Yes, that's it. You got it. You express it so well. She's tough herself. She's no spring, you know, spring chicken. She doesn't let him roll over her.
Right.
Even though she really her based in the outside world. Her whole education has come from books. She doesn't listen to music. She rarely watches television. She does what her controlling parents tell her to do.
Right.
She has no friends. But yet she also is a survivor with a perception of what her world is. And so they're very much alike in terms of what they see in the world. But she's tough.
Yeah.
And she will, you know, she will go after him if she thinks that she's being abused in some way, emotionally abused or verbally abused. So she, you know, she doesn't lie down on the railroad track, so to speak.
Right.
She speaks her mind. And this is his first time, like, whoa, you know, where is this coming from?
Mm-hmm.
And so he has to adapt.
Right. They both do. And you see that slowly evolving as the story evolves, I think. I wanted to ask about Sorry in terms of she's been driven to flee, obviously, but does she have any clue of where she's going? It seems like she doesn't really have a set goal. She just wants out.
Well, that was the original premise. It's funny because I went to a writer's conference, and I would encourage anyone who's a writer to go to a writer's conference. And they had a speaker, and the speaker was saying, well, you know, most young adult novels are written from perspective of women, and they're the ones that sell the book.
Mm.
So if you're going to write a young adult novel, write it from the perspective of a woman or a female. And, you know, I kind of bought into that. And so I started, again, rewriting the book from her point of view, you know, where she goes out onto the porch. She contemplates running away. Her parents are very controlling. She's scared.
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought, well, what the heck am I doing? She's not the star of this. He is.
Right.
And it has to be from his perspective because of the whole Jim Morrison thing and poetry and his point of view. And but yet she winds up explaining to him how she came to run away. And once again, it's all about research.
Right.
It wasn't enough to just say, well, her parents are very controlling.
Right.
I went into YouTube and I read some articles about teenagers who talked about their controlling parents and their helicopter parents. And it gave me a really good perspective on that attitude and why someone would want to run away from it.
Right.
And, you know, she has an uncle in Nebraska who's probably the only person who's ever been really nice to her. And she thinks this is her salvation. And so she has to figure out a way to get there.
Right.
So that's what she's looking at.
I was going to ask about where Sori came from, because what you have just described sounds so familiar to me based on younger generations. I am one of the oldest of Gen X based on when I was born, though I've never particularly felt that way. But I guess I am. It doesn't really matter to me. But it's when you see the younger generations and you interact and you work with them, whether it's in writing or you know, discussing our stories and, you know, have as I've done in circles with folks or other things, you get this strange sense of that the freedom that we had as kids is not there. And often you see the memes on Facebook joking about how, you know, when we were kids, we disappeared for 8 hours and we didn't have our parents checking in on us. And I do remember being the youngest. You know, my mom was constantly trying to keep me close, but at the same time, I knew why she did that, and I know she didn't mean any harm by it. But there's a point where, you know, when pagers and cell phones came into vogue and became the it thing for everybody, it's like now there's lifelines, and Sori, I think, is an example of someone who had sort of the in-home lifeline and she had to cut it. And that can be very scary, but it can also be incredibly painful, especially as you get a little bit older and you feel like you're, and suddenly you're behind the curve.
Exactly. I think, I worked in a college for a few years dealing with students, and you would see the helicopter parents that would come in and kind of hover over the kid, and the kid would be pushing them away, and it would be about everything. The classes they were taking, where they were living, the friends they were talking to, the professors, where they were eating. I mean, the encroachment was incredible.
Yeah.
And once again, I came from that generation. You know, my parents came from the Depression.
As did mine.
And they would be like, it's 8 o'clock on Saturday. What are you still doing in the house? get out there. You know, it's a nice day. Don't come back until dinner, until the street lights come on. And of course, you know, that's really a way to kind of explore the world. But now you have people that they never get out of their basements. You know, they're on the internet 24/7 and that's their educational system. They don't read books. They don't explore the world, per se. Their only reality is the internet, which may or may not be real.
Yes.
And so that is one of the things that really disturbed me, and I wanted to bring some of that into the book as well. I mean, it's set in 1993, so obviously, the internet was not well known, and of course, Jim lives off the grid anyway.
Right.
But yeah, when your whole world is YouTube or TikTok or a book, you know, if you just keep rereading, you know, Anna of Green Gables, and I love that book, but you're. Your perspective on life is so much different
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could see that very easily.
At the same time, too, I am seeing it change a little bit. I am seeing younger generations moving outward, and their expression is getting to their own thing. And we're starting, I mean, I think the internet is good for the expression in certain ways. And I think it's useful because it gives them a sounding board. It gives them an opportunity. And I am seeing it, though. It's like when I go to conventions and events, it's kind of fun to see young people stretching because, you know, sure, they're cosplaying or they're dressing up as their favorite characters, but they're interacting with other people and they're getting a chance to meet authors like me and you and others. And it's kind of cool to get to listen to them. And I think that the stretching out is going to happen. I think it's going to continue to happen as time goes on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think we do have it. That's the hardest thing for us as authors is how do we get people interested in a book? How do we get people interested in something? And I've talked about this before and I harp on it. And I shouldn't, but I do. I can't tell you how many times I've been at events and I've had adults, grown men and women, mostly men, say to me, "Oh, geez, I haven't cracked a book since I got out of high school," or
"Yeah,
I haven't read a book since I left college." And I'm like, and it's like, why? And he goes, and they say things like, "I just don't have time," or "People aren't writing what I want to read," or anything like that. And I always say, well, you're here. You came over here because you saw something. So can I interest you?
Right.
And mm-hmm. you'll hope that you can like crack that. You're looking just a little bit because as I tell people as well, look, you're looking at your phones all the time. You're reading something. You're reading mm-hmm. the news from there. You're reading your emails. You're reading the weather forecast. You're checking your stocks. And for the assignments that kids have, you are reading. Now, can we get you maybe to try something else? I guess the hardest part is just getting them to try. And maybe that's where we need to work a little harder.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not anti-internet. God bless the internet, because half of my research was done on the internet.
Yeah.
And I remember those days where if you wanted to learn something, you had to go look it up at the library.
Yep.
And that meant dealing with the card catalog. And it was so time-consuming. I mean, I'm in the library all the time, but not for research much anymore because I get a lot of it. And I always double check.
Yep.
You know, that's one of the things, you know, look for 3 or 4 sources. Don't just depend on one. But that's one of the things that I tell my students. If you haven't read, go to the library. Go to a particular area of something that you're interested in. Take a book off the stacks. Read the first page. If you don't like the book, put it back.
That's
you know, I can't tell you how many times I've done that. I mean, I've rejected hundreds of books just reading the first page and saying, I could never get into this, or reading the first chapter.
Yep.
And so I really, you know, people want to learn. And I think you're absolutely right. It's coming around full circle again, where this generation that's coming up is so curious about things and how things work and why it is the way it is and how it can change. I mean, it's really very 1960-ish in their attitude towards, you know, starting a couple of little mini revolutions in terms of the outlook on life and why things were always that way. So, yeah, definitely.
We're going to come back for our last break in just a moment. We'll be right back on the Brown Posey Press Show. Stay with us.
Sunbury Press Books is the home of independent authors and thinkers. Radio Free Press is our imprint for politics and social issues. Check out authors such as Pat LaMarche, author of Still Left Out in America, The State of Homelessness in the United States. Wingnuts, A Field Guide to Everyday Extremism in America by David Michael Slater. And A Year of Change and Consequences by Mark Singel. Find out more by clicking the books tab at sunburypress.com.
We're back with Jill Evans, author of Travels with Jim. And one of the things that we've been talking about is the differences that you and I had as we were growing up and more recent generations. And tell us a little about your history, because I've always found that a person's upbringing is so critical to what they do later on. Tell us about where you were from, what was happening early in your life that was pivotal.
Well, I grew up on Long Island in the suburbs. My parents came from northeastern Pennsylvania because in the 50s and late 40s, because there were no jobs. Mm-hmm. And so my mother was a college graduate. My father had been in the service and was trained as a draftsman. And the only jobs they could get were on Long Island. Right. Imagine their cultural shock when they came.
But
I would spend a lot of time in Pennsylvania because my grandparents and relatives still live there. And the dichotomy of the way people looked at things, the way villages and towns were put together, the cultural references. I mean, I grew up with Italians and people from, you know, from African-American neighborhoods and Hispanics and things. But when you go back into, you know, northeastern Pennsylvania, it's coal miners.
Yep.
It's Polish. It's Eastern Europeans. And you get such a broad outlook. As a matter of fact, one of the things that really influenced the book was, or the idea for the book, was when I went to see my grandmother on my father's side. My cousin Victor would be there. And Victor would show up in this beat-up truck that he would actually come down from the mountains, Appalachia, and he would visit. And he was just the best storyteller. And he would tell me all about it. I'd go into the truck and sit with Victor. And he was a very, very decent man. But he was much older.
Mm-hmm.
But he would tell me all these stories about shooting squirrels and going deer hunting and the men that lived in the cabins that were hobos, that they would hop freight. And so that was so exciting to me that this was a completely different world.
Wow.
And so I got a lot of inspiration from that. You know, and then coming back to Long Island, it's very cosmopolitan. It's near the city. So there's that influence. But it's also, you know, a lot more heterogeneous
mm-hmm.
in terms of viewpoints.
So you got the best of two different worlds, which is pretty amazing.
And my parents were readers. If there's nothing else to impart to parents, is be readers.
Yep.
And encourage your children to be readers. I mean, my mother would read anything. She was a frustrated writer. She worked in the sciences, but she would write on the side. My father would paint the walls of the house.
Mm-hmm.
On the, I think I was reading cybernetics when I was like 13, because my mother had all these books laying around, and so it was. I had a very diverse upbringing, and so they encouraged me to read a lot, both read a lot of philosophy, read a lot of adventures, read a lot of stories, read a lot of magazines.
Yep.
Because we always had Life magazine and things like that
yep.
around the house. But yeah, that kind of drew into things. And then I was kind of a little bit of a rebel growing up in high school and an artist and a writer. You know, and that kind of leads people down one path. And, you know, you find your passion.
Yeah.
It took a long time because I got married, had children, and had to put all of that on the side for a while, but you kind of get back to it. It never leaves you.
Mm-hmm. And you've done stories for, like we were talking about, you know, newspapers and so forth. That must have been a real charge. Like when your first story got published, I remember my first record review in a little magazine up in Maine in like the late 80s. And I was just like, I finally did it. It wasn't a very good review, but you learn.
Well, I mean, I write when I write and I get published in magazines and newspapers, it's usually memoir. Mm-hmm. And I teach memoir because once again, I go back into the memory book and pull out something that happened that might be very insignificant that a memoirist can write about. I'll give you a good example. I was in the supermarket about 10 years ago, and there was a man who came from Poland. And, you know, we all have those moments where we're in the supermarket and we have a cartload of stuff and there's someone behind us with three things. Uh-huh. And so I let him go ahead. And, he said, thank you very much. And I recognized his accent. And I said, Polska. And he said, oh, yes. And he got to talking. And, I said, I'm part Polish. And he started telling me this wonderful story of growing up in Poland. And at first, the Nazis came. Mm-hmm. And he told me a little story about the Nazis and the suppression of the Nazis. And then he said, well, the Nazis went away and the communists came. And he talked about the suppression of the communist regime in Poland. Mm-hmm. And he said, and then his face lit up and he talked about, finally, I got to America. I got to the land of freedom. Mm-hmm. And his eyes were so bright and his smile was so broad. And he said, now I can think what I want. Nobody's banging my door down. And he went into this little story about how wonderful freedom is and how wonderful America is. And I just thought that was such a joyous story.
It is.
So I wrote about it, But little things like that can influence you.
Yeah.
Into writing. Yeah.
That's a mini memoir. And there's somebody who totally appreciates what's here because, he was under two totalitarian regimes so much of his life. And then finally he got out of there. Isn't that something?
Yeah. But it's one of the examples of just looking for things that inspire you in your everyday world. No matter whether you're a writer or not, just open yourself up to the possibilities mm-hmm. of what you see around you, whether they're beautiful or ugly. Mm-hmm. Be aware. And I mean, once again, that's one of the things that Jim Morrison would always talk about. Just be aware of what's going on, what your perception is,
right.
What you're filtering, mm-hmm. And how it's filtering. So I grew up in a very creative environment and a very creative place in the world where I was influenced by, the Polish culture and very homogeneous area where people lived and died, and a very heterogeneous area where people would come and go all the time. So, yeah.
And that's great advice right there for us, for those of us that are getting started is, yes, keep your eyes open and that kind of thing. That's fantastic. I wanted to ask about your teaching. Now, you teach memoir primarily. Tell us about the art of that, because that's one in itself, isn't it?
It is, and very often the students that I teach, they're a little older, but I would really encourage younger memoirs, people in their teens and 20s and 30s, write it down. I mean, I had one terrific student. She was in her 20s, and she wrote these wonderful memoir pieces about high school. I mean, she didn't have to be 60 years old to write about it. She wrote about it. She was in her 20s. And unfortunately, she had to leave the class, but she would have had a terrific blog going on. Mm-hmm. Just writing about these crazy little things in high school that everybody forgets. I take a lot of lessons from the experts remember, if you can't remember, go to your photo book.
Right.
If you can't remember in your photo book, go to an old magazine. I mean, God bless the internet in that respect. If you don't, if you're writing about the 50s and you want to describe your living room but don't remember, Google 1950s furniture, you know, and that will give you that memory. And also, one of the advices I got when I was doing my master's, which I think is really important to any writer, even if you're a minimalist writer, is to bring in sensory detail. Yeah. You know, going to a diner, sit down, order a cup of coffee. What do you see? What do you smell? What's the chatter in the background?
Yeah.
What are the songs that are on the jukebox? Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you see out the window? All of those things can add to a memoir experience. Yeah. So I just, and it could be the smallest of things. It can be, you know, the smallest, the beginning, you know, I had to do an exercise again in my master's program, write five opening lines. And one of the opening lines that I came up with was, I now know what it's like to have a pumpkin as a head. God knows where I'm going to go with that. But, you know, it's that kind of,
never
that
can
kind
tell.
Of thing.
Never can
you
tell.
You never can tell.
Well, what is next for you, Jill? What's going on with you next?
I'm promoting the book. I'll be at the Sachem Library on the 26th of March in the evening with other authors. If anyone is in the area, please stop by. I'm working on a second book, which involves Vietnam from the domestic point of view. It's also set in northeastern Pennsylvania. And it's based, the setting itself is based on my experiences in Pennsylvania, the people I encountered, the cultures I encountered. So it's a very kind of home-centric type of novel, but it really delves into the Vietnam War from a domestic point of view. It's set in 1968, so if anyone, you know, recalls or remembers, there was a lot going on. So Bringing those outside elements in to how it affects this family is very, you know, germane, moral, small town family. So I'm working on that now.
All right.
Thank you for asking.
Well, thank you for being on the program, Jill. It has been a pleasure as always. My guest has been Jill Evans. Travels with Jim is available through Sunbury Press Books and also on online platforms pretty much everywhere. As always, Jill, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Brown Posey Press Show with your host, Tory Gates. Find his works, including Searching for Roy Buchanan, Call It Love, and Shake Hands with the Devil, along with more independent authors of fiction and nonfiction at sunburypress.com. Thank you for listening. This is the BookSpeak Network.